So it gives me really great pleasure to welcome Professor Hewson here up to the, and I'd ask you to join me in welcoming him.
Well, thank you very much, Jennifer. It's a pleasure to be here and to have been part of the launch last night. I mean, I think the idea of a public policy institute in Auckland rather than Wellington is a good idea. You're able to differentiate your product in a very meaningful way, I think, and broaden the links between the Institute and the broader community, the business community, civil society and so on. As was said, I'm an economist who tried to be a politician. Didn't succeed as a politician in the sense that I lost the 93 election. But I've been fundamentally interested in public policy all my life. As a trained economist, I tend to see things through that particular prism. But not necessarily. I do understand, though, that it's not just an economy we're talking about, it's a society that we're looking at reforming. I should start with a bit of a warning that I take from Lyndon Baines Johnson. You may or may not remember him as President of the United States, 36th President. Took over in very unfortunate circumstances from JFK. On the day he was assassinated, he was sworn in as President on the Air Force One on the way back from Dallas to Washington. He was a very interesting politician in that, unlike the current incumbent, he was able to use the Congress very effectively to get legislation through. He understood Congress, he knew how to make it work. And I guess his main triumph was in the 60s. He got all the civil rights legislation through the Congress at a time where that issue was very hot and very difficult. And I don't think any of the three Kennedys would have been able to do it myself. And he's a rough and tumble sort of politician. He called a spade a shovel whenever he could. And as head of his Council of Economic Advisers, he had a very famous Harvard economist, John Kenneth Galbraith. And he said to Galbraith one day, he said, "John, have you ever thought that giving a speech in economics is very much like pissing down your leg? Seems awfully hot to you, but rarely so to anybody else." I think it's a fair warning that I will stay away from some of the jargon and the detail. But I have been analysing and predicting economy since the late 60s, when I worked for the Treasury and then subsequently the IMF World Bank, IMF Reserve Bank and so on. In fact, we started the global economic forecasting process in the IMF in the early 70s in a very tumultuous time where the fixed exchange rate system had collapsed. The OPEC group had quadrupled oil prices overnight. The post-war stability of low inflation and strong growth, low unemployment was quite easily shattered, moving into recession, moving into a period of stagflation, and so on. So all through that period since then, I've been able to basically predict most of the major changes that have occurred in the global economy, whether it was a recession or a stock market crash or Asian crisis, GFC, whatever. You can see the build-up of factors. Economists, by the way, are lousy at picking the timing, but you can see the build-up of factors that will lead you to conclude that the change is coming, a dramatic event is about to occur. But as I stand here today, I think it's much harder to say how the world economy and so on will unfold from here on than it's been at any time during my working life. And I find that quite a challenging set of circumstances. There are a lot of reasons why that's the case. I'll just mention a couple. I mean, as an economist, of course, a lot of the relationships that economists took for granted seem to have broken down. You may remember the monetarist view that if you inject a lot of liquidity into the economy, you will soon risk a runaway inflation. If you look at the history of the last 15 years or so, the GFC was really created by excess liquidity. Greenspan pushed interest rates in the US down low, very low, and held them there too long. And it started a global search for yield, and all the investment bankers, financial engineers emerged, creating all sorts of new financial debt products, like not only subprime loans, but collateralized debt obligations, lending obligations, credit default swaps, and so on. A mountain of debt built on a subprime loan, which was itself a pretty shaky sort of concept. And it almost seems inconceivable today to imagine that anyone would actually offer a subprime loan, but they would lend up to 125% of the value of a house. at a very low artificial interest rate initially on a no-recourse basis. You know, if you couldn't meet your mortgage payments, you could hand the keys back to the bank. And, you know, that's sort of is just a punt on house prices continuing to go up, because as they go up, you keep building your equity, you can reset the interest rate and so on. But if house prices don't go up, you've got a problem, because those loans get called, and that's exactly what was the basis of the GFC. And those loans had been securitised a number of times in a number of frameworks in those other collateralised debt obligations and so on, so that when you pull the rug out of the bottom, the whole house of cards came down. And, of course, the central banks of the world didn't have much idea as to how that would unfold, because while they could let a smaller investment bank like Bear Stearns go, for example, they couldn't let Lehman Brothers go easily with it, because they didn't know the links, the contagion that would flow from that sort of financial collapse. And, of course, the whole system collapsed and predominantly tipped the world into recession or towards recession. And that was all because of excess liquidity. And what was the response of the policy authorities to that? More liquidity. We had this process of quantitative easing, pushing interest rates down to very low levels, in some cases negative, and holding them for a long time, pumping money into the system in the expectation that it would actually boost the economy. And it certainly didn't result in any inflation. As I said, the basic relationship you'd taken for granted didn't occur. Inflation, in fact, has been very flat, and deflation has been a challenge in countries like Japan, large parts of Europe, sometimes in the United States. It's a world that the policy authorities never contemplated. Central banks today have got huge balance sheets of bad paper that they've bought to inject all that liquidity into the system. They were talking, as the Fed is doing, of normalising interest rates, whatever normal means in this world, but they want to put them back up again. And it's very difficult to do, because they don't know how that will impact, whether that will impact negatively, for example, on economic activity, actually slow the pretty fragile growth that we've seen, or whether it will... you know, perhaps precipitate a correction in the stock market, the currency markets, the bond markets, and so on. I mean, it's uncharted waters. And so in those circumstances, it's a world that they've never contemplated. They don't have much more capacity. If there's another GFC, for example, another significant financial crisis, what are they going to do? Push interest rates even lower, put in even more liquidity in the system? And it doesn't make much sense. I remember when I was a graduate student at Johns Hopkins, one of my colleagues, we were all building macro models in those days, and... he built a macro model which, for a period of its implementation, implied negative interest rates. And the learned professors among the world's best threw it out on the basis that the concept of a negative interest rate was inconceivable. You know? And here we've had, you know, long-term bond rates in Germany, for example, a fairly, you know, effective economy, out to 10 years, for example, negative for large periods of time in the last 6 or 7 years. So that's a world that people never contemplated, and they don't know how to manage it, and they don't know how to disengage. But the basic relationship we took for granted, which was, you know, pour a lot of liquidity in the system, you'll get a pickup in inflation. We have very low inflation still, and in fact, inflation in most countries is still below the bottom of the target range. And we don't have any historical experiences on which to draw either. I mean, what they can't look back to the 20s or 30s or 40s and say, oh, that's what we did then, we'll... There's nothing, it really is uncharted waters from a monetary policy point of view. Also in fiscal policy, a lot of countries are still struggling to bring their deficits under control, what we call in Australia budget repair. It's one of those challenges that gets pushed out every year to another year. It never actually looks like being achieved, given the demands on governments these days and the commitments that are being made on the expenditure side. But, you know, you've still got very large budget deficits and, in many cases, significant levels of debt. And, Trump, for example, talking about his tax reform package and his infrastructure program, you know, ignores the fact that the US has still got a budget deficit of about 3% of GDP and debt of about 106% of GDP. So, you know, he doesn't have a lot of capacity to fund that. If you look at his recent statements on tax, he's about $2 or $3 trillion short of funding it. It's not going to happen very easily. So these are, you know, the constraints that make it very difficult, I think. The relationships have broken down. I mean, we used to believe in the trade-off between unemployment and inflation. That doesn't work anymore. You know, these sort of basic things that were fed into the literature over many years don't apply, and we're left with a world where we can't really draw on much historical experience and not too much academic research to suggest. I mean, we don't really know, for example, the full impact of negative interest rates because it's not a world that we actually thought about. And it's changed the thinking of a lot of people, but we're still grappling with that. So I thought against that sort of background, I might just make some comments about how I see circumstances unfolding in Europe, the United States, China, and then look at our particular circumstances here. Europe is obviously going through a very difficult period. I mean, the European Central Bank is still on a process of quantitative easing. They're still trying to pump money into the European economy. Motivation is, of course, to avoid what would be a triple dip recession with deflation, not an objective that they'd ever contemplated they'd have to worry about. But while that is in itself a very significant task, and at times they found it difficult to find the securities that they should buy to inject that liquidity, I mean, the disparity in economic performance within Europe is a major constraint. The challenge of mass migration coming out of the Middle East and North Africa is another major constraint. And, of course, the political uncertainty in Europe is very significant, as you've seen in a range of recent elections. And, of course, finally, there's some geopolitical tensions in Europe. So when I look at Europe, the growth has picked up in the last 12 or 18 months a bit, but way less than they had contemplated it would be or should be, and they're still struggling to actually manage the situation. But at the same time, of course, you've had the Brexit vote, where a key player in the European community, Britain, has decided in a referendum to step out of Europe, which has caused a lot of internal disruption within Europe. And the risk of fragmentation in Europe, I think, is very real. I mean, the early speculation was that maybe the Dutch would want to leave, maybe the Danes would want to leave, some of the old Eastern European countries may want to leave. Marine Le Pen in the French presidential election recently said, if you're going to have Brexit, we should have Frexit. There are significant motivations to break it down. And at the same time, of course, you've got pressures within the euro. I must admit, in my days in the IMF in the late 60s, early 70s, the concept of a common market made a lot of sense in both political terms and economic terms. But I could never get my mind around a common currency, because I couldn't see that the circumstances would be put in place that would validate that currency over time. And basically, it's giving up national policy sovereignty, fiscal and monetary in particular, in order to achieve that outcome. And it's still being resisted. You still don't have the coordination of fiscal policy that would validate it. So I've had this view, and I've been proved wrong consistently for the last 25 years, but it's an unsustainable currency in a sense. And if you look at the pressures within the euro and within Europe, they're very real. I mean, Germany tends to do okay in economic terms, mostly because they've been able to operate with an artificially low exchange rate. The euro for them is way lower than the mark would have been. So they've been able to develop a pretty effective export-orientated sort of strategy, building a significant export business, not only trading within Europe, but beyond Europe and into areas like Russia where they're heavily dependent. And mostly because they've been able to benefit from the artificially low value of that exchange rate from their point of view. The other extreme, you've got the peripheral countries. You've got Italy, Greece, Portugal, Spain, Ireland, that are really poor economic performers, have had very significant deficit problems, very significant debt problems. And you look at the extreme, say, of Greece. Well, when Greece came out of the GFC, it had debt to GDP of about 140%. Since then, they've been through various bailout packages, which have implied more and more austerity on the Greek economy. And the economy's actually shrunk by over 30% in the last 5 or 6 years. And yet the debt ratio has gone from 140 to 170, or to 180% now of GDP. They haven't made any net progress, but there's been real pain, and I don't want to offend any Greeks in the room, but the Greeks tend to not work very hard. They tend to want to retire early, many bureaucrats on generous pensions, and they certainly don't want to pay tax if they can help it. And so it's a very difficult system to reform, right? Yet the Germans are looking at that and say, well, you've got to reform. Now, the economic response should be, of course, that they'll never be able to repay that debt. And really, the only viable solutions, I think, are for them to exit the euro. Of course, the rest of the European countries don't want that. And to devalue the currency, their currency, go to their own exchange rate with a substantial devaluation, and basically a level of debt forgiveness. And the Germans, of course, won't contemplate any of that. And they've got very short memories, because in 53, the German debt was restructured. 50% of it was written off, and the other 50% was extended to about a 30-year maturity. And that's the sort of thing you'd have to do for Greece to give them a chance of trading out of it. And the tensions of that, not only just the economic tensions of Germany and others, the European Central Bank, the IMF, having to come in with bailout packages one after another to actually sustain, you know, support for the Greek economy, but there's a lot of tension within the system. I mean, it really means that as the bulk of that money sort of comes in many ways from Germany, it really means that some German worker in a dingy old manufacturing plant, probably in the old East Germany, has to work longer and harder so that some Greek bureaucrat can retire early on a generous pension. Very significant social tensions as well as economic pressures associated with that. And so that's a very significant challenge for the European Central Bank and the European fiscal authorities to manage that sort of circumstance. They are desperate, and you see the extent to which they're prepared to go, to keep the euro as a currency, not to let one break out, because if one breaks out, there would be a significant fragmentation. And there's a very strong move, of course, to try and hold Europe together. The leader of that movement, Merkel, has just suffered something of an election defeat, although she's was the most successful party. Her vote fell quite dramatically. And so, you know, the pressures in Europe at political level and economic level are very real. The mass migration issue is, of course, a substantial part of that, and it's certainly been the Merkel story. The Germans have always had a history of taking itinerant workers. They took a lot of workers from Turkey. You know, they said, while you're here, you've got a job, that's fine. When you don't have a job, we send you home. You will never be German, these people were told. And of course now Merkel has recently announced that she'll take 1 million more of these refugees coming out of the Middle East. That's in a population of 80 million. We'd be like in Australia, we'd have to take 240,000 to match that. I think we take less than 20,000. So it's imagine the political fallout of bringing 1 million people in over the top with an expectation of jobs and schooling and access to social security and so on. And that's the main reason why her political standing, I think, has collapsed. And in those circumstances, the pressure is very real, because a lot of the other European countries have just sort of closed their borders. And this is all part of a disturbing global anti-immigration trend, which I'll say a bit about in a moment. But in terms of Europe, the impact of that is significant. It was also a fundamental factor in Brexit. I mean, if you look at the issues in the Brexit vote, I mean, they were worried about how much Brussels was costing them. Although the so-called £350 million a week was nonsense, it was never that number. But also, I think the big issue was the fact that they'd never had an effective immigration policy, and one of the arguments that was run is that there are about 5 million people about to come across the border from Middle East and North Africa if we stay part of the European community and meet our responsibility to take some of these people. So they were three pretty effective bullshit arguments, but they managed to change the vote. And, of course, you may remember what happened with the Brexit vote, that young people in general didn't vote in any number. And while my friends in London were saying, don't worry, it'll be 60-40 in support of staying, it was in London 60-40 in support of staying. But the rest of the UK had a somewhat different view, pining for the past, perhaps, pining for a world that they would prefer rather than the one they've got. And so the vote went overwhelmingly, well, marginally, I should say, the other way. And then, of course, May, in her wisdom and arrogance, decided that she'd go to an early election to get a 100-seat majority that would put her in a powerful position to negotiate the Brexit. And, of course, this time the younger people basically did turn out and the vote went the other way, and she's now a minority government having to fight for every piece of legislation through the British Parliament and put a layer of uncertainty of these ministers that are retiring resigning, I should say, and so on. I mean, it's a very unstable government. As far as the Brexit negotiations go, she's fallen way behind in terms of an effective timetable. The Europeans have been very hard-line that they want a couple of issues settled first before they will contemplate a renegotiation of the trade relationship. They want to settle the Irish border question. They want to settle the Brussels payment. they want to settle the fate of European citizens in the UK in the future. And they've said they won't do any other negotiation until those three issues are settled, because the Brits have been squirming around trying to find a way to avoid that, but it's not going to happen. The deadline is an absolute deadline of March 2019. They're not going to make it. So you have to speculate as to what will happen with Brexit. I suspect that we might have another election in the UK that May will be replaced, and they might have actually retake that referendum and reverse it, rather than trying to come up with some sort of transitional arrangement with the Europeans to see. But it's a hard call, because you don't know. The impact, though, of this process on the UK economy is going to be very significant. There's early stages, I guess, are starting to show up. Carney, the Bank of England governor, actually pointed out before the vote some of the likely economic consequences over time, a drift back towards recession and so on. It's a very significant issue. Hasn't much happened yet, because I think people are hoping beyond hope that it doesn't all happen. But basically, the early signs of that sort of slowdown in economic activity are already there in the UK. And, you know, as a practical matter, it's a very difficult thing to do. I mean, in the longer term, if they were to exit the European community, then they'd have to negotiate bilateral, multilateral, or trade agreements with a whole host of countries. At the time of the Brexit vote, there are only 20 trade negotiators in the UK. And in Brussels, they had 600. So that, you know, the practical reality of building a whole new infrastructure to make that exit effective is very difficult challenges in itself. So I'm quite pessimistic about how these circumstances will unfold in Europe. You've seen in the recent European elections the same trend you've seen in the United States, what we've seen in Australia, to some extent, I suppose, in your recent election in New Zealand, but a significant disenchantment with government, with politicians, with the political process. You had a very strong anti-establishment, anti-political elite type of vote, which has been fundamentally important in these elections. For some reason, they keep thinking that, to a large part, I just interpret that as a protest. We find a way to protest, so let's not vote for the major parties. Let's find a minor party or an independent, a messiah, something that we can embrace to make the point that the system hasn't worked to our advantage. You've seen it in the German election, where, as I said, that not only did Merkel's party lose a significant part of its support, about 12 percentage points, I think, but the second most significant party did as well. And she's now going to have to instill negotiating a coalition. She'll have to take the coalition with probably the centre-right party and maybe some Green support. But for the first time since Hitler, the hardline right party has actually got a representation in the German parliament as well. So it's a very, very unstable political circumstance. Now, you've seen it in the recent elections in Austria, you've seen it in Czechoslovakia, you've seen it in France. I mean, Macron in France is a classic case, where he was a member of minister of the socialist government, remakes himself as an outsider, comes in from the outside to the presidential race without any party structure at all at the time, wins, builds a party structure and, of course, goes into government. And now, of course, he's doing things that nobody imagined he'd do. You know, he didn't sort of mention them on the run-up to the campaign. He's nationalising a shipyard. He's trying to attract bankers from London to Paris, because they think the London financial system will go there. And you've seen a significant correction in his popularity already. But the mood is to move away from the major parties and to minor parties and independents. I think probably not because they really think they're going to govern or that they're going to actually make that much of a difference, but they will work to shake the place up. And that's the circumstances, I think, that exist right across Europe. Varying degrees, different issues in each country, but the sentiment's pretty much the same. It's certainly anti-major party, anti-government, anti-political elite. When I go to the United States, I mean, what do you say? I mean, all my uncertainty, my assessment that it's a riskier time than it's been at any time in my life, I could have said before Trump. Now I've got another layer of uncertainty. Because Trump has got, to me, just a classic case, again, of a sentiment in support of an outsider. Even though he ran as a Republican, he positioned himself as an outsider. I think most of the support there was a protest vote. He promised to shake the place up. He promised to drain the swamp, you know, whatever the sentiment was. And he built enough political support to get across the line. And I think if you look at it, and I said this publicly at the time, his initial strategy was quite a clever evidence-based strategy. They did a lot of work analysing which groups in the American society had been left behind. And the most obvious group was the grumpy old white males, the low to middle income white males who hadn't had an increase in their standard of living for a couple of decades. So focus on them and say that you're going to do something about their plight. And then link that to, you know, some of the issues. For example, they must have lost their jobs in the Rust Belt states because of Chinese imports or Mexican imports or immigration, people flooding across the border taking their jobs. Now, of course, all that's nonsense. Mostly those jobs went because of technology, robotics, you know, artificial intelligence and so on, something of a technological revolution. They're not going to come back. I was asked before the election whether Trump could win, and you have to say in politics, you can never say never, and so I'd said, no, well, there'd be three things that have to happen for him to win. One would be, of course, that there'd have to be a low voter turnout. Secondly, all those independents and minorities that voted for Obama would have to stay home and not vote for Clinton. And thirdly, which seemed most unlikely, he'd win all four Rust Belt states. And he did. Those are the circumstances which got him across the line. Didn't win the popular vote by, what, maybe 3 million votes, something like that, but certainly won the Electoral College votes. And fundamental to that was the Rust Belt states. But he's raised expectations in those states, which he's just not going to deliver against. I mean, his initial response to demonstrate some bona fides was to put a tax on Mexican imports on the basis that I'll use that revenue to build the wall. Another nonsensical idea, because he'd never heard of planes or tunnels or boats or anything. He just had a wall. And the amazing thing there is, of course, that the impact of that tax is on American consumers. It's not on the Mexicans. They're sitting down there laughing. No, it might affect their trade, but it's certainly they don't pay any of it. And you've started to see a shift in his thinking about that. I noticed in the current trip to China, where he was sucking up pretty significantly to Xi, the Chinese leader, he's changed his rhetoric entirely on trade. You know, he wants to re-establish a better relationship, but, you know, if you go back and look at some of the things he said during the campaign about the Chinese, I mean, it's a different world. Because I think he's recognised that, you know, it's one thing to say I'm going to put up tariffs. It's quite another thing to look at the consequences of that, because nobody else is going to sit there and just let you do that. The possibility of a significant trade war-type response is very real. And I don't think he's come to the view that, and you've seen, he stepped back, he's renegotiating the NAFTA agreement, he's pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership for now, but he's realising that, you know, there are consequences to those sort of national decisions, which probably are not in the best interests of the US, because it just brings the whole house down to a lower level within which the US is trying to do better by itself. So, you know, but he did feed this anti-globalisation sentiment, anti-free trade sentiment, anti-pro-protectionist, if you like, sentiment, as well as in the context of an anti-establishment, anti-government sort of sentiment. And that's had a very real impact on him getting there, but whether he can actually deliver anything against those expectations is another question. And, of course, whether he should. I mean, I think if you look objectively at the benefits of globalisation, the freer flow of goods and people and trade over the period since the Second World War, it's been fundamentally beneficial to the world. It's significantly lowered global poverty, for example. But I'm the first to admit that some of that wasn't handled very well, particularly in some countries. And the impact in the US, for example, on inequality has been a very significant factor, that downside, if you like, of globalisation. So it allows somebody like Trump to capitalise on inequality as a political strategy, but not really doing anything about it. And to reverse that globalisation process, to start restricting trade and restricting the flow of people and restricting capital is just counterproductive to the interests of making America great again. In fact, I think that's what's starting to be recognised by Trump. But my God, I mean, how do you read that guy? And I think he went into politics as, you know, a successful reality TV host where you could fire people, you know, and you're in, you're out sort of thing, control the whole process. You can't run a government like that. And he was the leader of the free world trying to run a government with 140 characters, now doubled, I think in response to Trump. You know, that's these 3 a.m. tweets that he sends out as if stating positions. And then I've got two concerns about that. One, he doesn't drink. So at 3 o'clock in the morning, this is real. This is him. You can't put it down to alcohol or whatever. And the second thing is that it seems to be a growing acceptance of this. This is sort of the new normal. And for me, that's an appalling thought. If you factor that through this process and what it means for American politics, I think it's a significant issue. But Trump has found also that he just can't govern. Not only he still hasn't filled a lot of his appointments, political appointments. He's had trouble with some of the major ones, and of course a lot of instability in his own office. In the American system, you've got very effective checks and balances in the domestic decision-making process. Congress cannot be taken for granted. And although the Republicans have control of both houses of the Congress, he can't count on their support on any piece of legislation. And the best example of that is, of course, if you look at the Republican Party over the last 8 or 10 years, their cause célèbre has been to reverse Obamacare. And they've had 3 attempts at that and they haven't been able to get any of them through. Today, of course, the focus is on the tax package and, making some progress, although it was set back a little bit yesterday. But, you know, what that will end up looking like compared to what they think it will look like or what they've proposed is a very significant shift. It's going to take a long time, if indeed in the end Congress supports. I mean, he's already lost 3 senators and his margin in the Senate's only 2. So, I mean, it's not easily going to go through the Congress, whatever it is. And if you look at the numbers, I mean, sure, he's lowering the corporate tax rate to a low level, trying to build a system probably to bring the money that's kept offshore back onshore and so on, restructuring some of the personal tax rates, simplifying them, but although to the benefit of the high income earners. I mean, these are issues that are not easy to deal with anyway. But, of course, in his numbers, he's $2 or $3 trillion short in terms of funding it. So is he either going to close down a whole lot of other loopholes, or is he going to increase other taxes and charges, or how's it going to be done? Because he doesn't have the fiscal capacity to do it. Now, that's a pretty messy process through the current Congress, I should say, where he really can't count on their support at all. Interestingly, the stock markets have been consistently punting on the fact that he's going to succeed with that and his infrastructure program. I mean, how else do you explain these record levels of the US stock market with price earnings numbers that start to worry me? The potential for a correction in that process of 10-15% is pretty real. And I don't know how that will be triggered either, but the stalling of the tax package may just be an element of that. So I think that, if you look at the US economy against that background, yes, growth has been better than expected in the last couple of quarters, perhaps. Certainly the employment performance has been phenomenal, but inflation's still very low. And the Fed is determined to put interest rates back up, as I said before, to try and normalise them, but, you know, it's very easy, very difficult for them to do that. They've been saying that for over 2 years. And the consequences of them doing that are not just domestic consequences, they're global consequences. And they're starting to work that out, I think, that they've constrained in what they can do. Putting the rates up in the domestic context may slow growth. You haven't had the pickup in investment from those very low interest rates, very low cost of capital in all the years since the GFC. I mean, the only reason that you've had earnings growth has really been through cost constraint and technology rather than growing the top line, the revenue line, which will only come if you have a significant investment boom, and we haven't had that. So I don't know how long that market can sustain those sort of numbers, but I suspect it won't take much to dislodge it. And if I go back to when Bernanke said, as the Fed chairman, that he was going to stop quantitative easing and start to taper it down, the consequences of that announcement were that in the emerging world, currencies and stock markets of all emerging countries fell between 10 and 20% in the following week to 10 days. because the US has a big impact. Not its interest rates just don't matter in the US, they matter globally. The emerging world's got at least $20 trillion worth of US dollar denominated debt. You start playing around with the domestic interest rate, and some of those countries are already in recession. They can't service the debt they've got, and you're going to make it that much harder for them. I think the consequences of that are very real. So the Fed is very constrained. The fiscal situation in the US is very constrained. But while Trump is constrained by domestic checks and balances in terms of domestic policy, there are no limits on what he can do internationally. As you've seen, he bombed an airfield in Syria. It's a bit of a sort of a preemptive strike, or whatever you want to describe it as. But here's a man who keeps using more and more inflationary rhetoric against North Korea, and who knows where that will go. I mean, both sides have elevated that conflict to a level where I think most people are genuinely concerned about how it might unfold. My concern is that we are now at the mercy of really an accident or a miscalculation. I mean, one of those missiles flying over Japan, if a bit falls off and lands on Japan, what happens? You know, that sort of event could occur relatively easily. I don't believe that North Korea will ever be the aggressor, although Trump likes to paint them that way. I think they want to be recognised as a nuclear state. They look at countries like Israel and Pakistan and India and say, you know, why are we so special? You know, and the world's attempt to reduce nuclear capability hasn't worked. So it comes to a world of containment and deterrence rather than... So I think that's the basis on which they will in the end negotiate something. But in the meantime, I think you can expect North Korea to continue to antagonise Trump. They won't be the aggressor, mostly because China's told them that if you're the aggressor, we won't back you. If you're attacked, we will. But they'll keep firing rockets out into the sea, probably just outside the territorial waters in Guam. Probably will ignite a nuclear bomb in the Pacific somewhere to keep making the point, antagonising Trump. But there aren't any military options. Anything would bring a reaction from North Korea, even a flyover of North Korean territory. They fly around the border, they put the ships out off the coast, that sort of thing, but I don't think, you know, they can have an effective military response because most of the artillery, traditional artillery in North Korea, is focused on Seoul. And it would wipe out a couple of million people in a heartbeat if they were to be attacked. So I don't think, you know, you really have a military solution. It has to be a negotiated solution. And how do you get North Korea back to the table, particularly when you offend them and call them little rocket man and other things day in, day out? It's not an easy situation, but the potential for a country like Australia is very real. I wrote a piece recently saying we shouldn't be complacent about this. We should be doing more in a diplomatic sense than we're doing in Australia, for example, because we have a very effective... part of the US intelligence system in Pine Gap. It's in the middle of the Northern Territory. I mean, they could knock that out in a heartbeat, cause the US a lot of pain, wouldn't kill too many of us, but they could actually do that. And so why would we be complacent and say that sort of thing can't happen? Because if it were to come to a military response, I mean, those sort of changes are not out of, those sort of events are not out of the question. So I see the US situation is very complicated and very hard to pick because you just don't know what Trump will do. He's mellowing a bit. He might be given the choice in the next 4 years that either you don't stand again or we impeach you. These elements are starting to emerge. But, you know, in the meantime, we're going to have a lot of volatility, a lot of uncertainty and very little economic and social policy direction, I'd suspect, in the US. Say something briefly about China. I'm a China pessimist. Skeptic might be a better way to describe it. I've had a long history in China, personally. I was the first Western leader, for example, in 1990 to go to China after Tiananmen Square, when everyone disowned them and were pulling back diplomatic relationships and so on. Bob Hawke, our Prime Minister at the time, said, well, we've got to let all the Chinese students here stay here. So let's have a visa category for that, which I strongly supported. But then he wanted to close our embassy in Beijing and he wanted to, you know, break off diplomatic and economic ties and so on. And I thought that was an insane position. So I led a delegation to China in early 1990, to make the point, basically, that, look, you know, you as a country, obviously expanding, will become the second or first most significant economy in the world in a couple of decades or so. You want recognition for that. You want to join the World Trade Organization. You want to get a greater standing in the IMF, in other institutions and so on. In order to do any of that, you're going to have to start meeting Western standards of human rights. And I put that argument to the Li Peng and Jiang Zemin and all the senior ministers over about a three-day period. As you can understand, it didn't go down very well. They don't like people saying directly to their face what they really believe. And I was then asked to be their guest, nevertheless, at the first major sporting event that China had ever hosted, the Asian Games. I refused because I thought that was just propaganda. So my last lunch was a 13-course banquet in 12 minutes. The plates were going in and out faster than we could put the chopsticks into them. But since then, I've had a lot of experience, not only in academic terms, political terms, built a number of businesses in China, had them steal that one of those businesses completely by simply changing the land use rights. And over that period, I got used to a whole lot of things about China which are ignored in the West. One of the most conspicuous aspects of China is that they're one of the few countries that actually target GDP. You know, we don't target GDP. We target unemployment, maybe, or inflation. We don't target GDP. And if you look at our GDP numbers in any developed countries, New Zealand, Australia, wherever, they bounce around from quarter to quarter. Look at the Chinese numbers. 6.8, 6.8, 6.7, 6.8. You know, like, that's a fiction. I was in China one time in the middle of the month of September when they announced the growth rate for the September quarter before the quarter was finished. And we can't do that in our system to, you know, in Australia, that's the first week of December to announce the September quarter GDP numbers. They're manufactured numbers, and they are selling a message with those numbers to the business community, to their broader community and so on. My own assessment is, looking at other economic indicators, the growth rate is not 6.75 or thereabouts, what they say, probably 4 or 5%. And that starts to expose all the structural weaknesses in China, Chinese society, Chinese economy. And there are many of them. China is the most indebted country in the world. Total debt is more than 300% of GDP. And a lot of that is financial sector debt, and not just traditional banks, it's all the fringe banks and non-banks and so on, where, you know, when I was doing businesses in, you know, in some of the industrial centres on the East Coast, I was there one day and the Beijing Bank of China announced that they were going to put interest rates up and they were going to restrict to increase reserve requirements, they were going to slow the growth in the economy. And the mayor and the local bank are saying to me, just don't worry about that. We'll fund this project, we'll get it up and running, we've got a local bank. And that's the sort of behaviour that has seen China rapidly build way in excess capacity in business, in property and so on. So you have a property bubble, you have a business capacity way in excess of what's realistic and so on, built on debt. And at some point there will be a reckoning of that debt. Even though they've got large international reserves, they really can't easily draw on, you know, there's a limit. I remember when I was in China once and the head of ICBC, the chairman of ICBC, I had a meeting with him and he was thinking of floating ICBC on the International Stock Exchange and asked me my advice as to, you know, what investment bank to use and so on. I just said, I can't imagine you can float. You know, I've just looked at your balance sheet and you've got a huge volume of non-performing loans. Don't worry, sir. Don't worry. The government will pick them up. And they did. They cleaned that balance sheet up, they listed the company, and now they've gone back to making non-performing loans again. You know, this is a mentality that is fundamentally a structural weakness. And the economy's had overinvestment for many years, 55, 60% of GDP going into investment. Now they're trying to make a transition from an investment-based economy to a services-based economy, a technology-based economy. It's happening, but it's happening much slower than they ever imagined it would be, at the pace at which it would occur. So that's another significant structural weakness. Then you've got pollution. Particulate pollution is very bad to the point where it's a massive health hazard and they have to clean it up. It's one of the main reasons why they've embraced climate change and renewables. They have to clean up their system, particulate pollution. 50 metres down the road in Beijing or Shanghai, and you see what I mean. You can't see. I went to the Beijing Olympics, and I was fascinated that all the other times I've been there, literally I couldn't see. Here is clean as a bell, because they closed all the industry around Beijing for several months beforehand, all the heavy industry, to clean up the air. And they micromanage everything, because during the Olympics it got quite dry and started to get a bit dusty, so they started bombing clouds of an evening to make rain so that they clean the place up. But, that's a major structural weakness. Corruption's a major structural weakness. And I know Xi's been out there with an attack on corruption, but I've had the view all along it's more about him consolidating his position rather than actually cleaning up corruption. It's a way of life. And, of course, you've got a lot of other demographic factors. I mean, by 2050, there'll be 250 million more Chinese aged over 65 and 240 million less under that age to support them. Now, that is a huge structural shift that's well underway. Those sort of changes are very significant. So you've got debt, you've got the over-dependence on investment. So you've got big bubbles. You've got bubbles in property, bubbles in their stock market, for what it is. It's mostly a mum's and dad's stock market. There's going to be significant correction at some stage. I remember a few years ago I was given an award from wine industry in China, one of the small industrial centres. I was in a new convention centre, and very latest technology. In fact, we didn't walk onto the stage. We stood outside and the stage moved and we just came in and came out again, this sort of thing. And across the road was the hotel where we were staying, and then as far as the eye could see were retail, commercial and residential buildings, completely empty. Built way in anticipation of demand and built all on debt. So I walked out of there absolutely convinced that those arguments about the overcapacity in China are very real. So for countries like Australia and New Zealand, the risks that I've just talked about internationally are very significant. You've got economic challenges, you've got political challenges, uncertainties if you like, and you've got geopolitical tensions. Not just North Korea that I mentioned, but the Middle East is far from being resolved. Iran, still Russia versus some of its satellites, Ukraine and others, still trying to re-establish the old Soviet Union, whichever way you want to look at that. These are very significant tensions, and a lot of lesser ones. I mean, China in our region, South China Sea, everyone's completely misreads China, I think, on that. Yes, they claim those islands in the South China Sea, right? The world complains, oh, God, that's terrible. And while we're complaining, they go and build a military base on there. Then they start restricting flight paths and navigation routes. And everyone complains, but nobody does anything about it. And they're doing that in a very way, and they've got confrontation with the Philippines, with Indonesia, with Japan, These are tensions that are very real, and it won't take much to ignite any of that, apart from the big one I said, which is what's going to happen to North Korea. So I think the uncertainty and risks are greater than at any time, and they are a combination of economic challenges in a world which we never imagined we'd be in, I think, as economists, with political tensions and this anti-establishment, anti-political party, major political party, anti-government sort of sentiment, which manifests in anti-immigration to some extent, anti-free trade to some extent, anti-free capital flow to some extent, and then, of course, the geopolitical tensions that are on top of that. So I think the challenges for countries like Australia and New Zealand, which are small, open economies that really do depend on that global trading environment, are very real. And we get sort of sucked along in some of these processes. I mean, I've been annoyed in Australia that we just back the US in whatever they say about North Korea, where we could, as a middle-ranking power, actually initiate some things ourselves in terms of a better and more effective diplomatic process, which might lead to a more broad-based diplomatic solution than we have. So I think I'm supposed to stop now.